to verses and numbers of words. Perhaps it's longer than the Gospel of Luke, but it's an important gospel written by Matthew, an eyewitness, an apostle who was a witness to the Lord Jesus' ministry. He's writing as a believing Jew. Luke is a Gentile, writing more for Greeks. And here Matthew writes, and he's consistently going back to the Old Testament to cite various verses and things to underscore who Jesus is and what he's come to do. And we'll be expanding on that today. We covered chapter 1 at Christmas, particularly the birth account. Let's begin in chapter 2, and I'll read the first portion of the chapter. I'm planning to cover the entire chapter. Now, after Jesus was born in Bethlehem of Judea in the days of Herod the king, behold, wise men from the east came to Jerusalem, saying, "Where is he who has been born king of the Jews? For we saw his star when it rose and have come to worship him." When Herod the king heard this, he was troubled, and all Jerusalem with him. And assembling all the chief priests and scribes of the people, he inquired of them where the Christ was to be born. They told him, "In Bethlehem of Judea, for so it is written by the prophet, 'And you, O Bethlehem, in the land of Judah, are by no means least among the rulers of Judah, for from you shall come a ruler who will shepherd my people Israel.' Then Herod summoned the wise men secretly and ascertained from them what time the star had appeared. And he sent them to Bethlehem, saying, 'Go and search diligently for the child. And when you have found him, bring me word, that I too may come and worship him.' After listening to the king, they went on their way, and behold, the star that they had seen when it rose went before them until it came to rest over the place where the child was. When they saw the star, they rejoiced exceedingly with great joy. And going into the house, they saw the child with Mary his mother, and they fell down and worshipped him. Then opening their treasures, they offered him gifts, gold, frankincense, and myrrh. And being warned in a dream not to return to Herod, they departed to their own country by another way." This is God's holy, inspired, and infallible word. May he add his blessing to its reading. A number of years ago, when our children were still at home and still in school here, they were at Midland Academy, the charter school. We had a family that was in my son's class, and they came from Mexico. They were working at Dow. And we had a good time visiting with them and getting to know them. And one Christmas season, I don't remember exact circumstances, the kids were out of school. We were visiting, and I was asking the mother about their Christmas, and she was asking about ours. And it came out that their tradition was that they didn't really open gifts on Christmas. And I probed a little bit more, and she said, "Well, in Mexico, we have this tradition of opening presents on the 6th of January, the Three Kings Day. In Spanish, it's pronounced something like Dia de los Reyes." It's a Spanish tradition that was brought to Mexico, spread to Central America, South America, places in Europe, where they observe Christmas, and then there's like 12 days in between. Then they, on Epiphany, the 6th of January, is when they do their gift opening. It coincides with what they believe was when the wise men came and visited Jesus in Bethlehem. Now, we'll talk more about that in a moment. But if we read this chapter and all we understand about it is that it's about the wise men from the east, we're really missing quite a bit of the story, because there's a lot more that's going on here that meets the eye, particularly in the second half of the chapter. Now, as we read this, I'm going to say this at the outset. Don't get impatient with me saying, what are we supposed to do with this passage? Where are the points of application? It's a historical narrative. The only imperatives, the only commands in the story are from the characters of the story. Herod giving orders to the wise men, the angel appearing, say, do this, go here, do this, and so forth. There are no imperatives for you and I in the passage. Passage is written in the indicative tense. The application is twofold. Understand the passage, secondly, and believe what it teaches. Let's begin in the first portion of this, what I just read, about visitors from the east. Now, we are told here that Jesus is just summing up, born in Bethlehem of Judea, in the days of Herod the king. This is Herod the Great. This is of the different Herods. There's a Herod during the life of Jesus, and I think there may have been one later after him. Those are descendants of the original Herod. The fact of the matter is he's actually near the end of his life. We learn about this in verse 19, because after Jesus and his parents had taken him to Egypt, eventually this Herod dies, and his son, verse 22, Archelaus, begins to reign and rule in the land. Bethlehem is important. It's the place where it's believed that Jacob buried Rachel. It's the place where Ruth met Boaz. It's very significant in the history of Israel. And at this time, wise men, the Greek word is magi, came from the east to Jerusalem, saying, "Where is he who has been born king of the Jews?" Now, these wise men are coming from what is modern-day Babylon, Persia, which is Iran. They're priests, experts in the religions of their own country. They probably were involved in interpreting dreams. They clearly studied astrology, the stars and the planets. They had their own sacred writings that they pored over. They pursued wisdom. They were experts in various secret arts of the world at that time. And they come to Jerusalem with a question: where is he who has been born king of the Jews? I was indebted to Leon Morris in his commentary for making the very salient point. Their question isn't, "We have come seeking the one who will one day become king in Israel." No, we are coming the one who has been born king of the Jews. He was king upon being born. That's the point that they are making. They've come because of the star that arose, and they've come to worship him. Now, of course, they're referencing a star that they saw in the sky that announced the birth of the Savior. And in the account, the star is then appears again and guides them to the actual place where Jesus is with his mother. But there's a secondary meaning to this term, the star. And perhaps people took this prediction very literally, because in Numbers 24, as Balaam gives his prophecy about the future of this people that Balak wants to defeat, and he's called Balak to curse, he gives a prophecy that a star shall come out of Jacob and a scepter shall rise out of Israel. And so the star is really a reference to the Messiah. That's how the Jewish people understood it. And so that there was an actual star in the sky that appeared gives double meaning to this prophecy. A star appears in the sky, but this person is like a star who will have a scepter in his hand, who will rule the nations with a rod of iron. Now, the star itself, there are all sorts of naturalistic explanations, and astronomers and planetariums will have programs in the late fall, going into the Christmas season, trying to recreate what the solar system looked like 2,000 years ago, to recreate and say, look, this talk about a star was actually a natural occurrence of things in the heavens, of planets and stars and other things that we know were going on. That's not what the text is teaching. It can't be, because that phenomena occurred when Jesus was born, but it occurred again to lead the wise men to the place where Jesus was. So we have to conclude that this star, whatever it was some sort of supernaturally created light that guided them to the place where Jesus was. Finally, they say the reason they've made this long trip is because they have come to worship Jesus, meaning at least to show him reverence or homage. We don't know about their spiritual condition. Herod heard about this, and he, along with all of Jerusalem, were up in arms and troubled. He called the chief priests and the scribes of the people. Now remember, Herod, I think, had a partial Jewish background, but he wanted the title king of the Jews, but he was not an observant Jew. He just He just really wasn't that into that stuff. So he calls the chief priests and the scribes and inquires of them where the Christ was to be born. He's troubled in part because he knows the prophecy that from the line of David, a son will arise who has a legitimate claim to the throne. He's concerned about being pushed off the throne. They tell him the Christ is to be born in Bethlehem, for so it is written. And you, Bethlehem, in the land of Judah, are by no means least among the rulers of Judah, for from you shall come a ruler who will shepherd my people Israel. He summoned the wise men so that they know that it's supposed to be in Jerusalem. If this actually happened, this star, and this king has been born, they're going to find him in and around Bethlehem. Herod has a secret audience with the wise men, ascertains from them what time the star had appeared. Now, and so he's getting an idea, based on their travel, how long ago the star had been seen. Now, traveling by foot or even caravan is not, you know, a matter of a couple days' journey coming from Babylon or Persia. We're talking months, perhaps a year or more. He got the time frame and he sent them on to go do what they were to do, to search diligently for the child. And when they have found him, report back to him, because supposedly he wanted to come and worship the child as well. So they go and they make their way, heading towards Bethlehem, 5 miles or so away. The star appears. They hadn't seen it for quite some time. And it led them to the place where the child was. They rejoiced exceedingly, verse 10. And going into the house, verse 11, they saw the child with Mary, his mother. It's almost like the star is above the house, and you can imagine a beam coming of light coming down. Maybe it was like that. But what's important to realize here is that not only did the star lead them to the place, but where is Jesus? Is he in a manger? Is he in some sort of a barn or their livestock present? It's in the house. The whole nativity concept is kind of thrown off at this point because he's not in a manger, as we are led to believe by maybe popular culture or the traditions that have come down through the years. What did they do? They fell down and they worshipped him. Again, were they believers? We don't know. And did they comprehend his divinity? Maybe, but maybe not. But they knew he was great. They knew that he was born a king, and they showed him homage. So they worshipped him and gave him gifts of gold, frankincense, and myrrh. Gold, of course, is a precious metal. We don't know how much they gave. Frankincense is a resin that's used in incense. According to Exodus, it could be used on the altar. And myrrh was likely a type of sap that was used in incense and perfume. Now, some people understand these gifts as somehow related to Jesus's death and burial, that the frankincense and myrrh in particular would have been used towards embalming his body. And that's why they gave these gifts. I didn't see any tie to that at all in the sources that I read. I think it's better to say they gave him the best of what they had, and the gifts then served to pay their way as they were going to be heading to Egypt shortly and help pay their way while they were in the land. After visiting, they were warned in a dream not to return to Herod, and they departed to their own country by another way, verse 12. Verse 13 then opens with the flight to Egypt. So the wise men are told, don't go to Herod, go back to your land a different way. What about Mary and Joseph? When the wise men had departed, an angel of the Lord appeared to Joseph in a dream and said, rise, take the child and his mother and flee to Egypt and remain there until I tell you, for Herod is about to search for the child to destroy him. So we have a warning. Get out of town. Herod wants to destroy the child. Kill him. And Joseph, verse 14, arose in the middle of the night, and they started their journey. He didn't wait for dawn. He didn't wait for the Mary to wake up. He didn't wait for the baby to get nursed or anything else. We're on our way. We're out of town. And so they headed to Egypt immediately. Now, the reason for this, obviously, is the safety of the baby Jesus. Mary and Joseph had already been told through various witnesses and in various ways the significance of the birth of Jesus. All of the hopes and dreams of Israel all throughout the Old Testament are going to come to fruition in him. Think of the burden that they bear about this child. We've been entrusted with this child. We have no money, we have no weapons, we have no means to protect ourselves. All we can do is flee. And flee is what they did. And God paved the way and led them to safety. But there's another aspect to this, why they fled. And it's in verse 15 when it says, "This was to fulfill what the Lord had spoken by the prophet," this is Hosea, "out of Egypt I called my son." That's a very strange reference here that Matthew is drawing up. I want to expound on this more this afternoon after our fellowship meal. But the fact of the matter is, you go back to the book of Hosea and you read that passage, and though Matthew is citing it as a reference for the Messiah, the context has nothing to do with the Messiah. The book is about Israel's waywardness. And Israel is like a wayward wife to God, who portrays himself as a faithful husband. The book is named after a prophet who was told, "Hosea, go marry a wayward woman, and your life will be a living example, a pantomime of Israel's relationship with me." And the book is all about Israel's waywardness. And there's this point in chapter 11 where it cites this verse, "Out of Egypt I called my son, and yet my son strayed from my ways." Why would he do this? To cut short to the chase, what Matthew is doing is helping us to understand that there's a parallel between the life of Jesus and the history of Israel. That Jesus' flight to Egypt and his return from Egypt is meant to parallel Israel's departure out of Egypt. The theological term, and you've heard me use it before, is the term recapitulation. That the life of Jesus is meant to recapitulate Israel's history. So just as Israel came out of Egypt, Jesus is going to come out of Egypt. Israel went through the wilderness. Jesus was in the wilderness 40 days and was tested. You think of Israel coming into the promised land. Were they faithful? No, not really. They weren't. Jesus coming in faithful to the end. So there's this concept of recapitulation in the life of Jesus, that he's recapitulating Israel's history. I want to expound on this more this afternoon, so I hope that you'll be here for that, and if not, hopefully we can record it. So we then come to verse 16 about Herod, and when he realized that he had been tricked by the wise men, he became furious. He sent and he killed all the male children in Bethlehem, and in all that region who were 2 years old or under, according to the time that had been ascertained from the wise men. Why would he kill all the baby boys, 2 years old and younger? If somehow the wise men were able to make the trip in just a matter of days. He chose that time frame because approximately when they saw the star and it took the time for them to get their caravan together and to make the actual trip, probably 18 to 24 months had passed before they arrived. The star had been seen. Jesus had been born. The angels had announced it. The shepherds told the story. Israel was asleep at the switch. They didn't care at all that news. They weren't really all that concerned when they heard about this birth that took place in Bethlehem. The only thing that stirred them up was when the wise men showed up. And then began to realize, oh, the Messiah is supposed to be born in Bethlehem. I believe he gave the orders to basically make sure that there was no possibility that when the star appeared, coinciding with the birth of this child, that this child will not escape the sword. So he gave the order, kill all the baby boys 2 years old and under, somewhere between maybe 10 or 20, maybe upwards of 30 children were slaughtered at the king's orders, all because he wanted to retain his power. Matthew turns to the Old Testament again and says, This was fulfilled what was spoken by the prophet Jeremiah. A voice was heard in Ramah, weeping in loud lamentation, Rachel weeping for her children. She refused to be comforted because they are no more. Go back to Jeremiah, and you read Jeremiah, and there's no reference at all to this slaughter in Bethlehem. The passage in Jeremiah is about the past. There is a long history of Israel losing its sons, some to war. Some were hauled off into exile and killed when the Babylonians conquered. Others were being hauled off into exile under the Babylonians. So we had the Assyrians first, then the Babylonians coming in. All sorts of death and destruction. You can go as far back as the book of Genesis and the life of Jacob, Genesis 42. Joseph, in his mind, is dead. Simeon was left in Egypt. He's likely, in Jacob's mind, also dead. And then he hears the news, you want to take my son Benjamin? He'll be dead to me too. So this verse in Jeremiah is actually like a summary verse summarizing Israel's mourning its sons and attaching. It's like a poetic way of describing the weeping for her lost sons. And Matthew finds this verse, or uses this verse, and says, this describes the mourning in Bethlehem. This describes the sorrow of the people in Bethlehem in light of what Herod has done. It's very much, in Matthew's mind, like what was happening during the Babylonian conquest. There's an aftermath to the story. Herod dies, verse 19. And at that point, an angel of the Lord appears to Joseph in a dream, saying, rise and take the child and his mother and go to the land of Israel. Those who sought the child's life are dead. And he rose and he took the child and his mother and he went to the land of Israel. But then he heard, verse 22, that Herod's son Archelaus was reigning. He was not a good king. He didn't last very many years before he was deposed. He was afraid to settle in Judea and he went to Galilee. And he went and lived in a city called Nazareth, that what was spoken by the prophets might be fulfilled. He shall be called a Nazarene. Here's Matthew going back to the Old Testament again. And yet I will tell you, you will not find a reference in the Old Testament that he shall be called a Nazarene. Did Matthew get it wrong? What is going on here? Why would he say, as the prophets have said? One writer puts it this way. Perhaps Matthew is not quoting any specific Old Testament prophecy, but is referring to a general theme of the Old Testament prophets, that the Messiah would be despised, Psalm 22, Isaiah 49, Isaiah 53, Daniel 9, comparable to the way in which the town of Nazareth was despised in the time of Jesus, John 1. Can anything good come out of Nazareth? Was what was said when Jesus appeared and began his ministry. So this term that he would be living in Nazareth and would be called a Nazarene is probably linked to the fact that in Matthew's day, Nazareth was just didn't have a good reputation. And the fact of the matter that he would come from there would fit with the Old Testament witness that the Messiah, though sinless, would be despised by his people. Now, in conclusion, if we read this account and we marvel at the visit of the pagan wise men, who are actually more spiritually in tune than the scribes and the Pharisees, we've done well. And we can be amazed at God's providential care for Jesus as we read the story of how God kept him safe. We can even read the account of Herod and be outraged at his order to slaughter these babies. But if we've done all of this, we haven't quite, and we're ready to leave, we haven't quite finished our job in understanding the passage. Remember, as I've been teaching through the Bible, that we connect Scripture back to Genesis 3:15. And in Genesis 3:15, the words were given to the serpent that there would be perpetual enmity between him and the woman, between his offspring and her offspring. And a day would arise when a descendant of the woman would come and would enter into battle. The serpent would bruise his heel. This woman's son would crush his head. What's going on in this passage is another battle, a lead up to the final battle of that promised battle in Genesis 3:15. We read this account and we have to see that the serpent is involved in all that's going on here. It's the serpent that is involved with Herod. Herod is aligned with the serpent. He's a seed, aligned with the seed of the serpent. Joseph, Mary, Jesus are aligned with the seed of the woman. And Jesus is the one who has been sent, the expected one who will crush the serpent's head. And here at his most vulnerable point, the serpent is conspiring to destroy Jesus through Herod's order. Herod thinks he's just preserving his own kingdom. And a surface reading of the passage is just, well, we have two kings. We have Herod, who thinks he's king, and Jesus, who is the king. Well, there's another kingdom here. It's the kingdom of darkness. That is, and Herod is merely a pawn in all of this as he's holding on to his power. He thinks he's trying to eliminate potential threats to his power. He's really waging war against God and his anointed. He's a fool. And as we see, Jesus is kept safe. They flee to Egypt. The threat passes, and the devil waits for another opportunity to try to destroy his foe. But this passage also is reminiscent of another passage at the other end of the Bible. In Revelation 12, we read this scene of the woman and the dragon. And a great sign appeared in heaven, a woman clothed with the sun, with the moon under her feet, and on her head a crown of 12 stars. She was pregnant, crying out in birth pains in the agony of giving birth. And another sign appeared in heaven. Behold, a great dragon with 7 heads and 10 horns, and on his head 7 diadems. His tail swept down a third of the stars of heaven and cast them to the earth. And the dragon stood before the woman who was about to give birth, so that when she bore her child, he might devour it. She gave birth to a male child, who is to rule all the nations with a rod of iron. But her child was caught up to God and to his throne, and the woman fled into the wilderness, where she has a place prepared by God, in which she is to be nourished for 1,260 days. That chapter, that section, also gives us a picture into what's taking place in this section of Matthew's gospel. And if we read Matthew, and we just talk about the scene of the wise men visiting and get all caught up in who they were, what their names were, what countries they represented, and so forth, we're not really fully understanding the story. And if we read the account and we get all upset about Herod and his order to slaughter these innocent children, that's important, but that's not the main thrust of the story. The main thrust of the story is that this is another of those skirmishes between the Lord's anointed and the devil doing what he can, trying to take out his mortal enemy when he is most vulnerable, and he is thwarted, and he's unsuccessful. And we know how the story ends. The devil thinks he's won the victory when Jesus is crucified, only to realize he has lost the war when Jesus is raised from the dead 3 days later. The bruising of the heel is the crucifixion, the death and the burial. The crushing of the serpent's head is the resurrection. So let us keep these things in mind as we work our way through the gospel. And hopefully you'll be able to be here this afternoon as we talk further about this idea of recapitulation and explore the theme more fully. Out of Egypt, I called my son. Let's pray.